Chapter 6. Maria Farmer's Story. The Artist and the Paedophile. Before she was legally gagged, I was able to interview the brave Epstein survivor, Maria Farmer, whose Twitter handle is @artisticblower. Her account that follows shows the psychopathy and deviousness of the people in Epstein's world. I first met Jeffrey Epstein in 1995 at an exhibition at the New York Academy of Art. I was 24 years old and had just graduated from my course at the Graduate School of Figurative Art. All the graduating students got to display one of their pictures, but, being an overachiever, I decided to display 3 paintings. I was absolutely thrilled, as this was the first time I had ever got to display my pictures in a gallery. Even better, I sold all 3 paintings that night. The only pictures that were sold in the show. But sadly, my night was about to take a turn for the worse. One of my paintings was of a young girl reclining on a couch while a man watched her. It was a tribute to Degas's famous painting, The Rape, and the model was my 15-year-old sister, Annie. I was just celebrating having sold the painting to a German man when the Dean of the Academy, Eileen Guggenheim, found me. When I told her the good news, she wasn't happy at all. She told me I had to give the check back because another buyer was interested. I said I wasn't going to do that, but she told me I had to do it for the Academy. I was terrified of Eileen. She had manipulated and abused me throughout my time at the Academy, so I felt I had no option but to do what she said. Reluctantly, I handed the check back and was introduced to Jeffrey and his partner, Ghislaine Maxwell. I had never met either of them before and had no idea who they were, other than powerful benefactors of the Academy that Eileen seemed desperate to please. Jeffrey told me he found my painting both beautiful and compelling, and that it got him thinking. However, he clearly didn't find it compelling enough to pay the full price. He wanted it for a discount. Half price, to be exact. I remember thinking this guy was incredibly cheap to be asking for a discount from a student. But I did what I was told, took his check for $6,000, and went home, hoping never to see him again. It wasn't the first time I'd been controlled against my will by Eileen Guggenheim. While I was a student, she had employed me as a maid and babysitter for her daughter. She paid me minimum wage, which was fine, except sometimes she didn't pay me at all. I often had to walk home so that I had enough money to buy food. But that wasn't the worst thing she did to me. Not by far. In my second year at the Academy, we had a Halloween party. The Academy had just moved to Franklin Street, and across the way was the apartment of a famous artist called Christian Vincent. I was dressed as Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, and Eileen asked me to go across the street and get Christian because he wasn't answering his phone. So I went over and rang the doorbell, and Christian answered immediately. He asked me if I had a boyfriend, and before I could reply, he had forced me onto the sofa and was smothering my mouth with his, almost as if he was trying to suffocate me. He tried to rape me, but unfortunately a phone call interrupted him. He had around 17 locks on his door, and I had to try and open all these locks to escape while he took the call. I told an artist friend of mine about it the next day, and the woman who had sent me over, Barbara Krulak, was fired. But Eileen never had any comeback at all. On another occasion, Eileen tried to set me up as some kind of concubine to a famous British artist in London. I had to speak to this guy on the phone, and he said, "So Eileen told me You'll come over and be my life partner. I was like, no, I will not. And I hung up. That happened on two other occasions as well. Basically, my time at the academy was one of manipulation and institution, but strangely enough, something I'd been warned about a few years before. I had been studying at an art school in the south of France as the final year of my undergraduate course at Santa Clara University in Silicon Valley. While I was in France, I saw this beautifully elongated study of a body in red pencil. I said to my roommate how much I'd like to learn to draw like that, and mentioned the New York Academy of Arts Figurative Art School. My roommate said instantly, "You can't go there. It's a paedophile ring." I remember not believing her at the time and thinking she was a bit weird. But the longer I studied at the academy, the more I realized she wasn't being weird at all. After the academy exhibition, I forgot about Jeffrey for a while. But only a few weeks later, I got a call from Eileen saying I'd been chosen amongst a select group of students to visit Jeffrey's ranch in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'd just obtained a position as an artist in residence at the Hamptons and was really happy. But Eileen was like, "No, no, no, you're leaving, you're coming here." Before I knew it, I was on a plane with Eileen, flying to New Mexico. The ranch was still being built then, but it was still impressive. It had its own fire station and even its own hospital, where Jeffrey claimed they could do all sorts of surgery. I remember thinking, why would you need to do your own surgery? Jeffrey said it was because a lot of people got bitten by snakes, but it seemed a little over the top for treating snake bites. He also boasted about the Clintons staying there in this old western village they had built. He tried to paint a picture of a place of learning, where scientists, politicians, and technology experts from all over the world came to share their knowledge. It has since been reported that it was the place where he planned to seed the human race with his DNA by impregnating 20 women at a time with his sperm. But none of that was mentioned at the time. The main house hadn't been built yet, and instead there was this double-wide trailer. Eileen instructed me to be complimentary about the ranch, so I said, "Hey, nice double-wide." It was meant as a joke. But I don't think Eileen found it very funny. Jeffrey thought it was hilarious, though, and said, "You get over here, you're so funny." We got chatting, and he was really charming. Just super funny and great to talk to. Perhaps Eileen noticed how well we were getting on, because before we went inside, she told me to sit on his lap and flirt with him, which I refused to do. Inside, things got even weirder. They held a dinner party, and when we went to the closet to put our coats inside, there was a skeleton hanging in it. I thought, is this ironic or something? At the party, they asked the students to play a game. We had to wear blindfolds and identify objects they passed around. It turned out the objects were fake breasts. They tried to get us to put them inside our shirts, but again I refused. Eileen was laughing, trying to make out it was all a hilarious game. And I remember thinking, wow, this is the dean of the academy. I met Ghislaine for a second time on that trip too. I had popped outside with Eileen, and she came riding up on a white horse in Ralph Lauren tweed. I'd never owned something that expensive in my life and just wanted to touch it. She literally looked like something out of a magazine, sitting there on that horse. Like Jeffrey, Ghislaine was glamorous and charming. She could make you feel like you were the center of the world. But she had a dark side too, as I would find out soon. Back in New York, I was out of grad school. I'm working for Eileen's sister, Barbara. I worked at her house for 2 weeks, cleaning toilets and helping her pack stuff away because they were moving. Barbara was even more verbally abusive than Eileen, and it all came to a head one day when I had gone to the deli to get some watermelon, and I was eating it in one of the empty rooms. Barbara was screaming at me, psychotically. It was so abusive that even her husband, a famous lawyer called Bert Field, said, "You don't need this." So I was sent away and paid with two expired traveller's checks and a bag of old junk which Barbara said I could sell at the flea market. I had to walk home because I couldn't afford the subway, and I ditched the junk on the way. When I got back to my apartment in Greenwich Village, I got a call from Jeffrey. He said, "Heard you had to work for that bitch Barbara, and guess what? You're having a real job tomorrow." So the next day I went to his office at the Helmsley Palace Hotel, because I was desperate for a job. Little did I know I was in for another surreal experience. Jeffrey was sat there with this Cheshire Cat grin on his face, and behind him, perched on the radiator, was the actress Morgan Fairchild. She didn't say a word the whole time, just sat there like this perfect plastic doll. I had this feeling he was trying to make himself look like the Great Gatsby or something. Everything was just so different, and fabulous, and weird. Also in the office was Katie Ford, the then CEO of Ford Models, Inc., and Andre Ballas, who was the owner of W Hotels. Jeffrey started asking me about my sister Annie, and I was telling him how smart she was and how she was going to be Ivy League. Jeffrey kept suggesting that Annie should model for Katie, and I was like, "No, she wants to be a doctor." Then Katie said she would call her friend Harvey. She was talking about Harvey Weinstein and get her a career in Hollywood. I kept trying to tell them she wasn't interested, but they didn't seem to listen. Alarm bells should have rung, but I was young and naive, and I needed a job. So the next day I turned up for work at Jeffrey's mansion on 71st Street. It turned out I was going to be a receptionist, signing people in and out. Ghislaine arrived and gave me all the instructions on what to do and how to behave. She also showed me several pinhole cameras that were positioned just behind my head. She seemed really proud of them for some reason. That also struck me as strange. The cameras were so small, you wouldn't even notice them, unless someone pointed them out. Right from the start, I saw a lot of young girls going up the stairs into the mansion. There were 3 to 5 a day, and sometimes as many as 10. I asked Ghislaine why so many young girls were coming and going. She told me they were Victoria's Secret models, and, at the time, I believed her. I began to see the dark side of Ghislaine while I worked at the mansion. She would come back from a shopping trip, all giddy with happiness because she'd just shopped, and then a few hours later she would say, "I'm going to get the new Biles." And her whole expression and manner would change to what I can only describe as evil. It was so sudden. It was like this Jekyll and Hyde thing. I didn't know what new Biles meant at the time, so I looked it up and found out it meant girls who had just started having their periods. I, of course, thought that was a bit weird. But again, Ghislaine said they were getting Victoria's Secret models, and they liked to recruit them young. That's when I found out she was working for Leslie Wexner, CEO of L Brand and Victoria's Secret. Ghislaine always made it very clear that she worked for Wexner. A few times, Ghislaine actually took me with her on these trips to find new Biles. We would go out in a black limousine with this creepy Hispanic driver, and friends of Ghislaine would often come too. One, who was often in the car, was Donald Trump's ex-wife, Ivana Trump. I remember her well because one time she gave me this really tacky plastic bracelet that I think came from her QVC channel. We would drive around Manhattan in this car, and suddenly Ghislaine would shout out, "Stop!" and she'd run out and speak to a young girl she'd spotted, often in school uniform. She'd exchange numbers with them, and the next day they'd turn up at the mansion for modelling. These girls were 12, 13 or 14 years old maximum. I kept asking her why Victoria's Secret needed such young girls, but she just said they needed nubiles. That was the word she used all the time. A couple of times, she slipped up and said she was getting nubiles for Jeffrey. I said, "I thought they were for Victoria's Secret." And she said, "Oh yeah, Jeffrey authorizes it." It was weird being around Ghislaine. She could be unbelievably charming, but then she could suddenly switch and turn into one of the most verbally abusive people I've ever met. The way she spoke to you could just cut you down and make you feel like the smallest person on earth. She could be physically violent too. She never was with me, but there were two Filipino maids at the mansion who were lovely, and she was sometimes physically abusive to them. Jeffrey could switch suddenly too. He would accuse someone of looking at Ghislaine funnily, or something like that, and he would constantly be getting rid of people. But he was never as verbally abusive as Ghislaine. I think they were both psychopaths, and that was how they controlled the narrative. You were so afraid of them switching from Jekyll to Hyde that you were always trying to keep them happy. I worked at the 71st Street Mansion for several months, despite not really knowing what I was doing there. During that time, a number of strange things happened. One time I was with Jeffrey in his Helmsley Palace office, when he said out of the blue, "Maria, you really don't know how to wear a bra." I was very self-conscious about my body, so I felt really embarrassed and didn't know what to say. But Jeffrey didn't seem to care. He sent me over to the Victoria's Secret store, which you could see from his offices. When I arrived, the staff were waiting for me as if Jeffrey had already spoken to them. They had all these bras for me to try on, but not one of them fitted me. So I just picked a pair of pajamas with the credit I had and got out of there. When I got back to the office, Jeffrey began describing my breasts. It was weird and horrifying. I had some unusual marks and scars, and he described them in perfect detail. He didn't even do it in a sexual way, but in this mean, nasty, critical way. I just stood there in a kind of shocked daze. It dawned on me that he must have pinhole cameras in the Victoria's Secret changing rooms that were connected to monitors in his office. He knew that I hadn't bought any bras as well, so he forced me to go back. I just bought a bunch of bras that I never wore and tried to forget about the whole thing. On another occasion, Ghislaine took me to her apartment, and the first thing I noticed was one of my own pictures hanging on the wall. It was the first drawing I'd done at the academy, and I was like, "How do you have that? I didn't give you that." She said, "Oh, I took it. I liked it." It had been in my apartment, which was secured with a police lock and deadbolt, so I have no idea how she got that picture. Anyway, I tried to forget about the drawing, and the next thing I noticed was these glistening objects on her mantelpiece. I asked her what they were, and she said they were ancient relics from Peru. They were solid gold and came from the British Museum in London. She told me her dad took them. I was shocked, thinking, you just don't take things from the British Museum. That's when I learned her father was Robert Maxwell, the famous British media tycoon, who had stolen millions from his company's pension fund, then died mysteriously on his yacht. I saw all kinds of famous people go up the stairs of the mansion on 71st Street. Bill Clinton was probably the biggest name. He came to the house three times when I was there, and each time everyone would have to clear out except the chef, Andy, and the two maids. I was usually the last to leave, and Glenn would be in a tizzy all day, sending people out to buy stuff and decorating the place with candles and ornaments. Glenn boasted about how much Bill Clinton loved her, and she wanted the place to be as perfect as possible. No one would ever believe me about this. But I've seen the photos of him there, and yes, as unbelievable as it sounds, the President of the US used to turn up at Jeffrey's house with no security detail, no announcements or anything. It was all very secretive. There was clearly something weird going on in New York, so I was over the moon when I got a job offer that gave me the chance to escape from Jeffrey and Ghislaine for good. I had received a commission to do some paintings for the movie As Good As It Gets by James L. Brooks. I couldn't believe my luck, and I was so thrilled to be doing something that was my chosen career at last. I told Jeffrey I was going to quit, but right away he was like, "Oh no, you can't quit." He knew I didn't have enough space to do the paintings at my apartment in Greenwich Village, so he offered to put me up in another of his properties in Ohio, which was on Leslie Wexner's estate, and I could complete the project there. He tried to make out like they'd already decided to send me there so I could be the Wexner's artist in residence. I didn't really want to move to Ohio, but the offer seemed too good to turn down, so I decided to go with it. I had wanted to escape Jeffrey's orbit in New York, but moving to Ohio turned out to be one of the worst decisions of my life. On Wexner's estate, things would get weirder and darker than they had been in New York, and from that moment on, I would never feel safe again. When I first arrived at the Wexner's estate in New Albany, Ohio, I was met by a man named Randy Bowie. He told me he was ex-Special Forces and was Leslie Wexner's right-hand man. He showed me around Jeffrey's house, which supposedly was just a guest house. But it was 26,000 square feet, based on the Rotunda building in Columbus, Ohio. Behind it was the Wexner's main house, and surrounding it were 350 acres of land. I had the entire guest house to myself, and I was feeling a little overwhelmed. Then, Randy Bowie told me that I needed to go inside to take a phone call from Abigail Wexner, Leslie Wexner's wife. He said when I'd finished, I should come outside again without getting permission from Abigail. When I asked why, he told me that they had Dobermans and sharpshooters all over the estate, so it wasn't safe. I remember feeling my heart sink and thinking, this is not what I'd hoped. This is really uncomfortable. Looking back, I guess that was the first clue as to what was coming. I stayed at the Wexner estate for 3 months, and the whole time I was hungry. I lost 20 pounds, and I was already skinny before I arrived. I couldn't eat, because I couldn't leave the house. Even though Jeffrey had arranged for me to get a driving license while I was there, and he'd left me his SUV so I could pick him up from the airport when he visited, still I couldn't leave. I'd call 100 times before anyone would pick up, and I'd have to ask permission to go outside. And it was all such a rigmarole, I ended up only going out 4 or 5 times. There was a country club nearby where I was supposed to be able to eat, but when I called Gillen and asked her about it, she said they wouldn't serve me because I wasn't Jewish. There was only one time I went outside without asking permission, and I never did it again, because this pack of Dobermans came running toward me, literally flying at me. I had my little Yorkshire Terrier with me, and these dogs would have ripped us both to shreds. I didn't leave the house for a month after that. The other weird thing about the house was the cameras. Just like Jeffrey's mansion in New York, the Ohio place had pinhole cameras in every room, and I was being constantly watched. I knew this because if I would go to the restroom or the shower, I would have Ghislaine shouting at me through a speaker from New York or London or wherever she was, telling me to get out of the shower. One time, I had a friend fly in to visit me. I was dyeing my hair with henna in the main hallway, and I accidentally spilled a drop on the carpet. It was so small I didn't think anyone would notice, so I just pulled a garbage can over it and walked away. About an hour later, I got a call from Ghislaine screaming at me that Abigail was going to have me thrown out for spilling henna on her carpet. There was such an uncomfortable feeling of being watched that I ended up doing my painting in the only places I thought didn't have cameras, like the garage and the pool house. There was also an underground level where I used to keep my photos and pictures. It had a huge sauna and a door that was always locked. One day, I asked the maid what was behind the door, and she told me it was an underground tunnel that led all the way to the Wexners' main house. She told me it led to a giant floor that would rise up into a room in the other building. There was also a huge walk-in safe where Jeffrey said Wexner kept all the recordings from all the cameras. I asked the maid how long she'd worked there and if she'd ever seen Wexner. She said 22 years, and no, she'd never seen him once. The other thing the Ohio property had in common with the New York mansion was that Jeffrey boasted about buying them both off Wexner for just a dollar. I asked how that was possible, and he said, "Maria, he adores me. He'd do anything for me. Trust me." I definitely think that Wexner was secretly homosexual, and that he had something going on with Jeffrey. Andy the chef told me there was definitely something going on between them, and I believed them, because he'd already worked for Jeffrey for 10 years, and before that, he worked for Wexner on his superyacht, Limitless. Jeffrey and Ghislaine visited Wexner a few times while I was there. It was on the last of these visits that my life changed forever. On the last night of their visit, Ghislaine came to my room to tell me Jeffrey wanted a word. She was in a robe, and I'd never seen her like that before, except when she was having her nails done by her servants. I followed her down the hallway to Jeffrey's bedroom. It was the one room I'd not been allowed in before. I went in, and Jeffrey was lying on the four-poster bed. Ghislaine told me to rub his feet. And I was like, "I know for a fact I'm not supposed to rub my employer's feet." Jeffrey said, "Come on, Maria. It's not a big deal. We're all friends." So, I took off his socks and started massaging his feet. He started moaning in this over-the-top dramatic way. So I pretended that I thought I was hurting him and said, "Let me please stop." He told me to come and sit next to him on the bed. Ghislaine came too and started loosening her robe. And I thought, "Oh, I'm going to be raped." I suddenly just knew. Jeffrey started touching my chest and kind of twisting it in this weird mechanical way. And Ghislaine mirrored him, doing the same thing. And at the same time, they were shaming me about the size of my breasts. At that point, tears started to come out. And Ghislaine took my hand and started patting it and kissing it, as if to comfort me. In a strange way, that was the most horrifying moment of all. While I was being assaulted, several revelations hit me all at once. I realized they were paedophiles. Suddenly, all of those young girls going into the mansion made sense. All of the pieces fitted together. Then their interest in my sister hit me. Earlier in the summer, they had flown her to the New Mexico ranch for what they said was a college planning session to help her get an Ivy League education. Suddenly I realized why they had really wanted her there. Had they raped her? Was she even alive? She was supposed to be in Thailand doing some program Jeffrey had sent her on. But was she actually dead? Then another realization struck me. My photos of Annie. I had several nude and semi-nude pictures of Annie and my youngest sister, who were 15 and 12 at the time. They were anatomy studies for my drawing class, and I kept them in a little plastic safe in the underground level where the sauna and secret tunnel were located. Somehow, I knew that Jeffrey had taken those pictures. I finally managed to get out of Jeffrey's room. My two little brothers were staying with me at the time, so I found them and took them back to my bedroom. I barricaded the doors and stayed there until the next morning. The whole night I kept thinking they were going to kill us all. I kept thinking about my mum and how she would handle the death of three of her children. The next morning, Jeffrey and Ghislaine had to fly out early. As soon as they had gone, I rushed downstairs to the basement and checked my pictures. The plastic safe had been ripped open, and some of the photos removed. I had everything catalogued and stored in envelopes, so I was able to work out exactly which pictures had been taken. One of them was of my youngest sister, and the other was of Annie, and they were both totally nude. I called Jeffrey's office in New York and told them my pictures had gone missing and I wanted them back. They hung up on me. Later in the morning, a girl from his office called back and told me the pictures were in Jeffrey's briefcase and he was using them. Then she hung up again. In the meantime, Jeffrey called. He said, "That was just so great last night. I just had so much fun with you." I told him he was sick and that I knew about the missing pictures, so I was leaving right away. Jeffrey was like, "Maria, no, no, listen. I will give you anything. What do you want to calm down?" I hung up and called 911. Unbelievably, 911 then hung up on me. I thought there must have been some mistake, so I called them back. The woman at the other end said very clearly, "Listen, the sheriff is at the gate. You're never leaving, okay? We work for Wexner." Then she hung up again. That was the new Albany Sheriff's Department. They basically all worked for Wexner. Now I was panicking and sure I was going to die. So I called everyone I could think of and told them I was at the Wexner Ranch in Ohio and that they were going to kill me. I called Eileen Guggenheim, and all she said was, "You must have really done something wrong," and hung up on me. Another girl from the graduate school seemed to find it funny and was like, "Oh, they're just swingers." Meanwhile, the head of security, Randy Bowie, had turned up, and he was pacing up and down outside. I've never seen anyone look at me the way he did that morning. There was pure violence in his eyes, and he said, "You are never going anywhere. You are never leaving, do you hear me? Never." In that instant, I felt all the energy in my body drain to my feet. I knew I was going to die. In desperation, I called my dad and said, "Dad, your sons are going to die." He was like, "What are you talking about?" So I explained everything and begged him to come get us. About 4 hours later, my father arrived in his car. I had to get my brothers out of there, but they wouldn't let him in, and it was a 3-mile walk to the front gate. And of course, there were the Dobermans and sharpshooters that Randy Bowie had warned me about. But by now, I was so desperate I no longer cared. I thought, you know what? They can eat me. So I walked my two brothers the 3 miles to the gate. I gave them to my dad, and then walked all the way back again. It sounds crazy, but all my art, all my pictures, all my worldly possessions were in that house, and I wasn't going to leave them. When I got back, Randy Bowie was waiting for me by the SUV. He promised me again that I would never leave. He tried to get me in the truck to drive somewhere else. But I remember this Oprah show where they said that if you were ever kidnapped, You should never let them take you to a second location, because that's where they will kill you. So I wrapped my arms around this fake Georgian column and kicked my legs and screamed and made a scene every time he came near me. When I was able to, I went back inside, because I knew they watched and listened to everything. I called basically everyone I had ever met and said in a very loud voice, "I'm at the estate of Les and Abigail Wexner, and their right-hand man is going to murder me." I think in the end, that's what saved my life. Because I had told so many people, they knew there would be no way of getting away with it. So eventually, 12 hours later, Randy Bowie must have got the message to let me go. He stopped pacing, but he was still salivating and looking like he wanted to kill me. He said, "You're never coming back, and if you do, you won't make it." I grabbed what I could, got in the SUV, and drove out of there. There were other Special Forces guys at the gate, but they didn't try to stop me or threaten me. Finally, I was free. I drove out of there and into a new life, one that would never be the same again. When I first escaped, all I could think of was, this is the end. I'm going to die. They're going to kill me. I went to Kentucky at first because my dad was there, so I felt a little safer. One of the first things I did when I arrived was to try to contact Annie in Thailand because I still feared that she was dead. Luckily, she was doing a real program that Jeffrey had sent her on. Clearly, they were still grooming her before the real abuse began. I spoke to the woman in charge, and she put Annie on the phone. It was difficult to communicate well on a payphone to Thailand, but I managed to ascertain that Jeffrey and Glenn had sexually assaulted her on her trip to the New Mexico ranch. The trip, which supposedly was to get career advice for entering an Ivy League college. I was horrified that this had all happened because of me. But at the same time, I was relieved because she was still alive. I spent a month on the couch at my father's before going back to New York. There I had another surprise. Jeffrey had rented out my apartment to his butler's son. This guy had thrown out all my worldly possessions and painted the whole apartment black. I realized I wouldn't be safe there, because they must have my key, and anyway, I'd already started getting threats. They would threaten to burn all my art, and much worse. Ghislaine threatened my life on several occasions. One time she said, "Hey Maria, I know you go running on the West Side Highway. You better watch your back, because you can die so many ways there." "Okay, dearie." These threats continued until about 5 years ago. I would change my number, and somehow she'd find my new one and call me again. On one of Ghislaine's calls to me, she said, "You're so stupid. Do you even understand what a big mistake you made?" I was like, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "Annie was going to get the privilege of carrying Jeffrey's baby. Do you even understand how amazing that is?" I was so horrified I felt physically sick. Annie was 16 years old at the time, and they were planning on Jeffrey impregnating her. It was almost impossible to take in. Another thing that happened in New York was that Jeffrey started stalking me. I would be on the subway or in the flea market or somewhere, and I'd turn around, and there he would be, just smiling at me. Eventually it got too much, and I left New York. But before that, I went to the NYPD. I knew a couple of guys from the 6th Precinct Department, and they believed me, but they told me it was too big for the NYPD and that I needed to call the FBI. So I called the FBI and told them Jeffrey had abused and trafficked me and my sister, and that they had stolen naked pictures of my younger sisters to use as child pornography. That alone should have been enough to get Jeffrey and Ghislaine put away. But the guy on the other end of the phone didn't seem interested. I told him I even had the envelopes the pictures were stolen from, with their fingerprints all over them. But he was like, no, we don't need that. I mentioned Wexner as well. I said he was the head of the snake. The funny thing was, as soon as I mentioned Wexner's name, I was handed over to another guy who told me not to mention anything about this to anyone. I put the phone down and waited to hear something back. But that was it. I didn't hear anything for 10 years. What makes me so angry is that all of the other girls that have been abused, all the girls in Florida, on the plane, and the island, all of them, could have been saved from that hell because the FBI had all the information they needed back in 1996. And what did they do with it? Absolutely nothing. I tried my best to forget Jeffrey and Ghislaine, and to get on with my life, despite the periodic death threats. The next time they really entered my life was in 2002. I was contacted by Vicky Ward, a journalist from Vanity Fair magazine. She was researching an article on Epstein's sudden rise to wealth and fame, and a mutual friend had tipped her off about me. Over the space of a year, I told Vicky everything that had happened to me and Annie. She interviewed every member of my family, and my dad even flew to an interview with her. She really got my hopes up that the truth about this monster was finally going to be exposed. But again, my hopes were dashed. Jeffrey got wind that Vicky was going to include me in the article. Somehow he got into the Vanity Fair offices one evening, and he threatened to curse Vicky Ward, who was pregnant with twins at the time. The editor, Graydon Carter, also started to have dead animals left in his garden and weird stuff like that. And I think everyone got spooked. Jeffrey told Carter to cut me and Annie from the article, and he did, and that was that. Jeffrey was off the hook once again. But that wasn't the worst thing. Vicky Ward told Ghislaine I had reported them to the FBI, so I got a call from Ghislaine threatening me again. That's when I went on the run, and that has been my life for the past 18 years. Constantly moving houses until they track me down and threaten me again. Unfortunately, it wasn't the last I heard of Vicky Ward either. She went to work for CNN, and it seems she promised them some kind of exclusive on me, because she harassed me and my family continuously about speaking to her, so much so that we had to send a cease and desist order. This was the woman who had promised my safety when interviewing me for Vanity Fair. Then had sold me out to Ghislaine Maxwell. There was no way I was giving her another story, especially because she became friends with these monsters. She was hanging out, having drinks with Ghislaine, and she became partners with one of Wexner's friends, who kept her in high style. All the while, I was hiding out in the woods, fearing for my life. She has sat on this story for 18 years, so as far as I'm concerned, Vicky Ward is a co-conspirator in these hideous crimes. I said the FBI did nothing with the information I gave them. And indeed, it wasn't until 2006 that I next heard from them. I was on the run, still hiding out in a gated community in the woods in North Carolina, when one day two FBI agents turned up at my door. I was so shocked that I thought they were there for my unpaid student loans. But in fact, they wanted to speak to me about Jeffrey. This agent, Nesbitt Kirkendall, had actually been working on the case for years. She was a mother, and you could tell she really cared. She really wanted to get this guy. Nesbitt told me about the Florida case, where reports had been coming in about Jeffrey abusing high school girls at his mansion in Palm Beach. She wanted me and Annie to testify, but she said the FBI couldn't offer us witness protection. I thought that was a pretty rough deal, but I didn't care. I wanted to get Jeffrey, and so did Annie, so we both agreed. The trial happened 2 years later, and me and Annie were waiting to testify, but we never got the call. It wasn't until 7 years later, about 5 years ago, that we actually found out what had happened. Jeffrey had got a sweetheart deal and been sent down on a prostitution charge instead of his real crimes of trafficking and sexually abusing children. The unbelievably slack deal sentenced him to 13 months in a state jail, during which he was allowed to leave the prison for up to 12 hours a day. He spent most of his time in his office, and it's even been reported that he was meeting young girls there. Not only did the deal let Jeffrey off the hook, but it gave immunity to all his co-conspirators, like Ghislaine, rendering them, effectively, untouchable. In terms of the victims, not only were we in effect branded prostitutes by the ruling, we weren't even given the dignity of being told about the verdict. This was why Annie and myself were still waiting to testify 7 years later. No one had bothered to tell us. I remember Nesbitt calling me around that time, but she was so distraught and in such floods of tears that I couldn't work out what she was talking about. As for her, the only good FBI agent I have ever come across, she is now completely incommunicado. Our lawyers have tried to reach out to her, but although she's supposedly still in the FBI, it seems she is under some kind of witness protection scheme. It's all very mysterious. Each time our lawyers have tracked her down, they found out from her neighbours that she left suddenly in the middle of the night. Who knows what kind of danger she has brought down on herself by daring to go against the likes of Wexner and the upper echelons of her own organization. My experience with Jeffrey and Ghislaine was a long time before the Florida victims, but I had visited the Palm Beach mansion a few times with Jeffrey and Ghislaine. I had been struck immediately by the pictures on the walls. There were lots of pictures of naked children, and also of Ghislaine naked. Another thing I remember was Ghislaine taking me to this room, and there were these leather straps attached to the wall. I asked, "What are those?" And she said, "I put my feet in, and I hang upside down like a bat for 45 minutes. It keeps me young." There was another contraption I asked about, and she said, "Oh, that's a sex swing, dearie." She seemed to find it hilarious that I didn't know what a sex swing was. There were various other sexual devices in the room, and also a massage table. I thought it was weird at the time, but now I can't even bring myself to think of what might have happened in there. One of the other things I noticed in that place, and in all Jeffrey's properties, was occult symbolism. Jeffrey had this statue of a creature with a goat's head that was called Baphomet, but which was basically a symbol of Satan. And at various places, they had these weird symbols inscribed on the walls, which I've since found out are occult. Another thing I remember clearly at the Palm Beach mansion was on a few occasions being told to go for a jog because Jeffrey was having a massage. So even back then, it was clearly happening. After the sweetheart deal, Jeffrey and Ghislaine became less a part of my life, thank God. Even the death threats began to dry up. However, my experiences left their own scars, which came back to haunt me. I was diagnosed with a rare brain tumour, and when I asked the doctor how long it had been growing, he said over 20 years. When I said that, I knew exactly when it had started. The moment Randy Bowie had told me I was never leaving the Ohio estate. It was so traumatic that even at the time, it was like I could feel my brain chemistry changing. That feeling of, oh my God, I'm going to die. They also found a second form of cancer, a kind of lymphoma on my heart. The brain tumor had become so bad, they told me, I was just 2 weeks away from permanently losing my voice. That was doubly bad timing, because Jeffrey was now being investigated again, this time by the NYPD. Fortunately, I had surgery just in time to save my voice, and file my affidavit. In July 2019, Jeffrey Epstein was arrested on charges of child sex trafficking. The same charges he should have received 10 years before. Annie and I felt a sense of elation, like we hadn't for many years. However, it was to be short-lived. Only a month later, he was found dead in his cell, having apparently hanged himself. The circumstances around his death were suspicious, to say the least. Failed CCTV cameras, sleeping guards, broken bones in the neck that only come from violent strangulation, and a bunk bed too low to hang himself from, to name but a few. I can add my own testimony to the list of reasons why Jeffrey's death was not suicide. I knew the man very well. He was a narcissist, and never in a million years could he have taken his own life. Right to the very end, he would have thought he was too important to be bumped off or left to rot in a prison cell. He would have been too confident in his own position to ever imagine he wouldn't get out of there lightly. Unfortunately for Jeffrey, everyone's luck runs out sometime, and he had obviously made himself too much of a liability to save even his own valuable skin. Probably rumours of him ratting out other conspirators to cut a plea deal was the last straw and meant he had to go. Some of these players, like the Wexners and the Clintons, are on another level, and Jeffrey simply had to be shut up. I just feel bad that the victims never got the chance to see justice done, and Jeffrey answer for a lifetime of the most terrible crimes. As for Ghislaine, people speculate as to whether the same thing will happen to her. I don't believe it will, because I believe she has protection from the highest possible levels. The Rothschilds, no less. I know this because she used to speak about them all the time. She called the Rothschilds the great protectors of my family. She used to brag about how they owned everything, and she could get them to do whatever she asked, particularly when she was making death threats over the phone. The relationship with the Rothschilds went back to Ghislaine's father, Robert Maxwell. She made it very clear that he worked for Israeli intelligence. She used to make me look at all these photos of him while she cried over them. She was constantly grieving for her dad. He had died a few years before in 1991, and some of these pictures were of his lavish Israeli state funeral. I asked how he had died, and she said, "Those cunts pushed him off the Lady Ghislaine." At the time, I didn't understand what she meant. But the Lady Ghislaine was his yacht, and Israeli intelligence had pushed him off the boat. There was definitely an attitude of racism and what you might call Jewish supremacy around Jeffrey and Ghislaine, and all that circle. The way they spoke about African Americans was horrible. It made me sick to my stomach. And they weren't much better about white people. They made it quite clear that you were inferior to them. I remember one time hearing Eileen Guggenheim's daughter, Isabel, saying, "Mummy, why do you call Maria a nobody?" And Eileen replied, "Honey, Maria is not a Jew. She is a nobody." I wasn't sure about Ghislaine's relationship with Israeli intelligence, since they'd killed her father. But she told me they had given her to Jeffrey to take care of. I didn't really know if by them she meant the Rothschilds or Israeli intelligence. But that's what she kept saying, that Jeffrey had been assigned as her protector after her father's death. She certainly had some hidden source of power and influence. That was very clear. Like when she showed me her passports. She had a French passport, an English passport, an Israeli passport, an American passport, and one other that I can't remember. I remember thinking, isn't it only legal to have two passports? How does anyone manage to get 5? And then, of course, there was her connection with the British royal family. I saw a lot of them at the New York Academy of Arts. Prince Andrew, Prince Charles, Sarah Ferguson. They were always hanging around the academy. But Ghislaine also showed me pictures of her growing up, and these pictures were all full of royals. She basically grew up with the royal family, and she was great friends with Prince Andrew and Fergie. The weirdest thing about seeing those photos was Princess Diana. This was back in 1996, when Diana was still alive, and she showed me this photo of Diana in tears, and Ghislaine was like, "Look, we made her cry. We hate Diana." That made me feel sick, because I idolized Diana. I had grown up basically wanting to be her. That was another occasion where I saw the evil side of Ghislaine just kind of take over. Now that Geoffrey is gone and Ghislaine is in jail, life feels a bit more normal. But after what was done to me, nothing will ever be truly normal again. I gave up painting for 20 years because of it. I had been painting from pictures of my younger sisters, and after what happened, I found it so disturbing I just couldn't pick up a brush. I've started painting again now, but it will never quite be the same. And I consider myself lucky. At least I was an adult when it happened. What about all those young girls? 14, 15, 16 years old, who had their innocence taken away. I can't even imagine what they've been through. And what about all the other girls? Only 30 women came forward to testify against Geoffrey. But I saw up to 10 girls a day going into that mansion on 71st Street. And that was just New York. What about Florida, Ohio, New Mexico, the island and his private jet? There must be literally thousands of women out there who have been abused by Geoffrey Epstein. Where are they? Are they even alive? The scale of this thing feels almost too large to comprehend sometimes. As my journey with Geoffrey began with Eileen Guggenheim, it seems fitting to end it with her too. The last time I saw Eileen, I went to visit her daughter, Isabel, at their New York home. I'd lived there as an au pair while I was studying at the academy, and I'd gotten to know Isabel very well. I'd practically raised her during the time I was there. Isabel had just gotten into a really great high school, so I was visiting to congratulate her and see how she was doing. As I was leaving, I spotted something shiny on the counter and wandered over to have a look. It was a gilded invitation to a benefit function in the UK, hosted by the royal family. The invitation was from Ghislaine. I looked at Eileen and said, "Are you kidding me?" And she said, "No, I'm not kidding you." After all I'd been through with Geoffrey and Ghislaine, because of her basically pimping me out to them, Eileen was still in touch with them. Still friends. I walked out of there and never spoke to her again. A week later, I found out that Ghislaine had gotten Eileen a job as Prince Charles's press secretary in the US. Since first meeting Eileen, Geoffrey, and Ghislaine, I have had many moments in my life where I felt kind of dizzy, like I was living in some kind of surrealist movie. This was one of those times. People often tell me my story is too far-fetched to believe. With the Wexners, the Clintons, the Rothschilds, Israeli intelligence, you name it. It's like it's just one huge conspiracy theory. Sometimes, it almost feels like that to me too. But then I remind myself, it's not a conspiracy when you've actually lived it.